This is Monday evening, November the 8th, 1965, a special meeting of the Tanana Yukon Historical Society in Jim Cassidy's home at 216 Slater Street in Fairbanks, Alaska. Our speaker this evening will be the Reverend B.J. Bingo, and this is introducing Reverend Bingo. To start out with, Reverend, we'd like to ask you your full name.
Bert J. Bingo.
And where were you born?
Well, there's northern Ohio, south of Toledo, about 30 miles. called a little place called Rising Sun. It's not a little ways out in the country from there.
What was your father's and mother's name?
Father's name was George and my mother's name was Della.
Have you any brothers and sisters?
Well, I had a brother named Henry, and I had five sisters.
Where were your early day schooling? Where was your childhood schooling?
Went to a country school in northern Ohio there, close home, and Rising Sun High School.
In what state?
Ohio.
Ohio. Now, tell us something about your life as a young man until you were ready to leave home. Some of your experiences.
Well, I can't say much about that except we lived on a farm and my father was a carpenter and he was gone quite a bit and that made me having to do quite a bit of the farm work. And also we worked and lived in the oil field, and part of the time I worked in the oil field as well as did the farm work and drove 5 miles to high school. And three of the years we went with a horse and buggy. And that was a little bit far to make that distance. And, of course, it means get up early in the morning and work late nights as well to get everything accomplished. And particularly if it's a part of playing in the athletics, why, you would have to be pretty, quite busy to take part in the athletics as well as to get home and do the farm work and to do the x-ray, which I did at the same time.
When did you go west?
After completion of college work, which was in 1923, went to school in Illinois for 6 years. I was out of between college and seminary work. I was out a year up in Wisconsin and in Kansas. Worked in the harvest for 3 months in Kansas, and then went back to Wisconsin. Worked in a gymnasium for 6 months for the Methodist Church, and from there I went for 5 months for the Red Pastor's Talk, was covering the southern states, and then back to the seminary. And after completing the seminary work, I headed out for Idaho, and was in Idaho for 5 years before coming to Alaska.
What induced you to come to Alaska?
Well, I sure didn't want to stay in the States, and a little bit too old to go to any other country because as far as our Board of National Missions was concerned, the Foreign Missions was concerned, they had an age limit of 30 years, and I was beyond 30 years, and so I was held out of the foreign field, and so Alaska was open, and I volunteered to come to Alaska.
How did you come to Alaska?
I came up on a boat with Alaska Steamship Line.
What was the name of the boat?
Steamship Alaska.
In what year?
1928.
And you landed?
In Cordova.
Now, I brought you on this far, Reverend Bingle. You take it from here now and give us the history and highlights of where you went from place to place and the exciting things that happened.
Well, I might say that they have a couple of townsfolks around here right now. Savannah was on that same boat, and also from Bert and Mary's down the highway there, Mary was on that same boat.
Was she?
Yes.
She lives right over here behind us now.
Yeah, well, anyhow, Mary was on the boat.
Hmm.
So we still run across each other once in a while, and yak.
Well, those things are interesting. We want all these names you can remember, marshals, sheriffs, village, town names, and so forth.
Of course, there's a few of the traveling salesmen are still on. I think Sam Baker was on at that time on that boat. But most of the salesmen are all have since retired, but came up on a steamship Alaska. Well, we arrived at Cordova, and of course, pioneer work, and I mean work in those days, was a little bit different than it is today in our church work. We had only three operating churches in Alaska at that time, and we had, that is in that part of the Alaska, we had one in Anchorage and one in Fairbanks and one in Cordova. Of course, we had a church that was not operating, but it was built in Nanana at that time, and one in Barrow, and a church that was built but not no minister there at Gamble on St. Lawrence Island. And we had a school teacher carrying forth the work at on St. Lawrence Island at that time. Dr. Grice was at Barrow, and Johnny Ewell was at Fairbanks. And when I came into Cordova, why, that made number two on the field, because all the other fields were more or less vacant. Dr. Grice was out on vacation, so Dr. Ewell was about the only one who was in Alaska at that time that I came in. So by fall, we had enough with Dr. Winterberger coming to Anchorage. We had enough for a presbytery meeting, which takes three, and so we met in Cordova for our first presbytery meeting. Well, anyway, we have a good meeting up there, and we had a good church. It was not too large at first. We have mostly adults at the while there. At first, we had services in the evening time because everybody works mostly in the daytime. And anyhow, we started having arrangements with the Episcopal folks. They had services in the morning, and we had services in the evening, and we sort of traded back and forth with congregation. But a little bit later, as our Sunday school grew, we found we were developing a nice group of young folks, and so we developed a young people's church there, and we had a very good going concern there in a few years with young people's organization, young people's officers, and the young lady that was in high school was playing the organ, or playing the piano, and leading the choir, and doing the instructing, and young folks doing the business end of the church work there. And of course, we had a very fine time. And Sunday afternoon, we usually took off. We brought the skis, and we usually went skiing. It was close to skiing time, and then on Tuesday evening, we had recreational time plus another study hour. And the evening time we had then on Sunday for the adults for the church services. So we had a very full program. And incidentally, we lived over the gymnasium for the town, and our church and our was not only the center of activity for the church, but it was also the center of activity for the town, and we were a part of it. Within a year, we became tied in with the Boy Scouts. I was handed that position, I guess, not because I knew much about the Boy Scouts, but because I did have some recreation training in school and gymnastic work and so on, and we were able to pick up the Boy Scout work, and with Francis Bowden, who runs a Hewitt's drugstore and owns Hewitt's drugstore in Anchorage. And Francis and I took care of the Scouts for 7 years in Cordova, for 6 years in Cordova. And we had an exceedingly good troop in Cordova, and I think possibly as good a troop as ever been there. And then we were able to build a get up. It was sponsored by the Elks Club, and we not only had good programs there, and had but very fine large troop, but we did summer activities, summer camp work and so on outside of the town of Cordova, summer trips, so on.
You spoke of McCarty in the mines. You must have been up there quite a bit.
Well, our work was in mission work as well as in town. Every 6 to 8 weeks, we were supposed to go up the railroad, the Copper River Northwestern, to the Kennecott Copper Mine. Of course, Chittenden was long away, and we'd have services on the way up, possibly for the folks in at the hotels and the up there around the hotel and the stores at Chittenden. And on the way returning, we'd have possibly have services many times. For the at for the natives out in the native village. But at KennyCon, we were able to have services at the mine. A number of people in Fairbanks today live at the mine and worked at the mine at the time. We had a very fine time at the mine. It was very, very interesting to work and to be there and call up in the homes. Some of the finest people in the north were at the Kennecott Copper Mine. Not only very informed people, but very cultured people. I never saw a group of people what you would say was well kept and well preserved as far as their conducts are concerned. Here was the central dining hall, for example, and you might have to come with your working clothes on in the morning for breakfast and lunch for noon, but evening time everybody was cleaned up and dressed up, and you came to dinner dressed up like you was an Englishman in the best of clothes. And it was just the way they did things there. You dressed up to go to dinner in the evening, and there was a high way of handling things there. And I ate sometimes over to the mess hall where the men worked, and very fine food. Eat either place, didn't make any difference. Very fine place to fed well, and the miners enjoyed it just as well. And I mean, just the same as the staff. And then up on the hillside, a little bit later, I had the nerve to ride a tram bucket up there, which is, of course, many of you know about the tram, because some of you have been in the tram and ridden it yourself, possibly some of the old timers. But it's an ore bucket that holds about a ton of ore, and it's only about 2 feet each way, and it's about a cubic foot, I'd say, 2 feet by cube. And so you get in there, your head might stick out and your feet might stick out, but the rest of you don't. And as you ride up the hillside there for 2 miles, and you miss the towers as you're with your head and your feet as you go by them, and then you take a rest as you swing over to the next cable and you go up 2 more miles up the mountainside. I didn't mind it so bad until they try to kid you along when they get you over a canyon, you know, to stop you out there over the canyon and let you swing out there for about 20 minutes and see whether they can make you holler uncle or not, you know.
That wasn't because you're a reverend, was it?
Well, I don't know. It makes you think of all the lousy things you said to your wife before you left home, see, but, when you were out there. But it was really... I wasn't the only fellow they treated like that, but they all treated all the chichogas that way, you know. But
Didn't you have some interesting weddings, marriages, or deaths to conduct in that village?
Well, I had one interesting marriage, but I wouldn't want to tell about that one because I really got in bad with the commissioner up there.
This is for posterity. The commissioner won't hear it.
You know, he died. But... No, he would have threw me in a hoosie gal.
Well, we'd like to hear it.
But anyhow, he was gone. He didn't leave anybody to sign the marriage papers. So we got the marriage papers and fixed them out and had the wedding anyhow before the lady left. So
well, you were kind-hearted.
But left him for him to sign them up afterwards. And he almost rolled me in the hoosegow for that, but anyhow, he never did forgive me that because he missed the wedding himself.
I think that's what he was mad about. So,
but anyway.
The bride would have left him. But
I don't know. I had a few weddings, but there are a few funerals too. But one I know that they had one there one time that they thought they were going to bury one person. Then he walked in town the night before. And everybody was scared because they didn't know what happened.
You mean you already had a corpse and then the live one walked in?
The live one walked in. And so that made it a little different, you know. So they had to rebuild the casket and dig the grave over. And it was really cold, about 50 below. And The young fellow that built it had to dig it to froze his feet that morning because it was really cold. But that wasn't so good. I think some of the boys in town here might know that because they were there. So
Sigwell and some of them?
Oh, yeah, Sig was there. So, I think Nell was there too, Bobby.
Reuben Johnson?
Yeah, Reuben should know about it. But they would, Mrs. McCann was there, I'm sure, but she was hidden down yet, I think. But that's quite surprising, you know, when you think you have one person and you don't have him, and you find out the person you have is much bigger than the person that you do have, you know. Yeah, it really is surprising. But
You dug a grave for a small man.
Yeah, that's right.
It turned out to be a large one that was dead.
I was just called in. I didn't make the mistake. I just was called in. I came in on the train, and that's what had happened. But so the men were quite disturbed, particularly the ones that came out in the evening and saw someone coming in. But another time too, we had a few other things happen along the way. I remember another case we had. This is with the Boy Scouts. We were a little bit leery about one of the ladies over there. I wouldn't call her a lady particularly because I didn't trust her too well, because I thought she made some bad biscuits for us that she made up there for us, and because we weren't trusting the biscuits too well, and she was telling us all about a shooting iron she had that she was going to give to her son someday, and we mentioned it to her about her husband wouldn't like it. She said, well, he'd never know about it. And when we got Boy Scouts got back from this camping trip up there that we were on, which was the camp was at their section house up in this area along the railroad. Why, 2 days after we were back, why, he didn't know anything more about it because he was shot. After the first jury was hung, why, the jury in Anchorage, I guess, thought she was a Sunday school teacher or something. I have to turn her loose. But
she had done the shooting.
Well, I don't know. She had good lawyers, and they said that she said that they could have. She could have. It could have happened, and the man could have gone and laid down, and the bullet hole still been straight over through him. Could have been still going straight down through the bed, I guess. I don't know how, but anyhow, that's the way the court read it. But. And she got loose, and then she went and took care of a colonel and his wife. But after she poisoned both of them, the government started looking into the case, and she found that he had five of them to her credit ahead of her.
Oh.
So.
This is the trick for the
boy scouts. Yeah, she's the one who made the biscuits, but we put the biscuits in the river. We didn't take a chance because the biscuits tasted bad, and we put them in the river. But.
Well, you were the one that tasted the first one, weren't you?
Oh, yes. And then I had DeLeo, young DeLeo was an assistant scoutmaster and junior assistant. He said, there don't taste right to me. So Dick Downing then was there. He's a commissioner of public works here now. And I said, Dick, you taste them. See, what do you think of them? And Dick says, they don't taste good to me. So in the river they go. And so in the river they went.
She wasn't there at the time to hear
this?
Oh,
no, she wasn't around there. So we thanked her nicely for the biscuits, you know. Oh, we wouldn't tell her about it. But anyhow, those are a few things that happen in your parish, you know. It makes it a little bit unusual, you know. But
from McCarty, where did you journey to?
Well, of course, occasionally, as I say, we went back and forth between Chittenden and McCarthy, Kennicott, and back to Cordova. But then we'd get down on the highway, the Richardson Highway, and at least once a year I'd try to make some of the places along the highway do some calling, and get out as far as Gulcana and Copper Center and off into the Gokona country and so on, and once in a while get up to the Paxton country. And
get up to Nabesna ever?
I was in Nabesna in 1934. I was in there and had services up there at the copper mine, or to the gold mine there for Carl Witham in 1934. That's quite a place up there, and I sure. I rode that tram bucket up the top of that mine there that one night in the dark, and that was really some ride. That was much steeper than the tram line of Kennecott. Oh, that was really steep. That was a much shorter ride than Kennecott, but it was really steep. But that's quite a place. I remember walking all around those slopes in there, and Carl says, "You better stay on that plank now. There's a little water under you." And so I walked on this plank. It wasn't too wide, but it wasn't too bad. And I suppose I followed a lamp, you know, he had on the hat, you know. Mm-hmm. Followed his light. I got across on this next rock over there. He says that thing must have been about 90 feet deep under you. I don't know. We don't know whether it was or not, but maybe he's just kidding me. But anyhow.
No, I imagine they were.
But it would make you feel funny, you know.
You didn't have to go back over there.
I didn't go back.
This brings you where to next?
Well, we were back, so we had more work on that because the depression came along, and they asked us to take care of help them with the depression. I mean, with handling woodyard for the folks of the town, and by virtue of the fact that we're head of the organization, everybody at the head of an organization, they threw in taking care of the woodyard. I mean, taking care of the people who needed help economically.
This is Cordova.
At Cordova, and so we said, well, everybody wants to do something for himself and earn his own way, so we bought a saws and some axes, and we volunteered to people who would burn wood, and so we had folks to go out and cut wood, and when we had set up a wood yard, and we then used our organization was the agency that dispersed the wood, that sold the wood out to customers, and gave them full value of what the returns were for the wood, plus we gave them clothes and Red Cross flour and other things that went along with it, and everybody had more or less something to get along, and the more wood he cut, the more he could get along with, and usually the folks were very good. I mean, they were taking care of people pretty well.
What year was this?
31, 32. And then toward the end, we were able to. I mean, in February about it was, I think. Maybe this was in 32. It was pretty rough, and there were a lot of the fishermen out along the beaches there. They were pretty hungry, and they were pretty short on cash, and a lot of them were really living on their beach without many changes of clothing, and so they really, some of those boys were even sold in their clothes for the winter almost, you know. And they were for food. They were eating clams, and some of them were eating seagull eggs. Really, then, so we showed up with Jacobson took the forestry boat out, and I don't know. I went along, and some of the rest went along. One of the men from the forestry department went along, and we took all kinds of flour out. We took clothing out. Anything we could find loose that was had this organization had around, and anything the government had loose, plus was ward from the war department there. They had a bunch of surplus clothing that they had left in town, and so we took that out. And the men along the beach said that Christmas never was better than this, you know. That was their thinking about it.
Very good.
And so we made a really good day out of it. Well, we were able to get along ourselves very well. Between Francis Bowden, who now runs and owns Hewitt Drugstore, and Merle Thomas, that lives in town here now, and myself, we went up on the hillside and cut our own wood and rolled it down off the hill and hunks of wood and split our own wood up, and we made got by with our own cells by burning wood instead of...
There was little coal or oil then.
Yes, there was that flare, but the cost was so high, plus your resources to buy it, you know. So Francis was cut down to half-time, and Merle wasn't hardly working that time, and so it was really kind of rough. So we took care of ourselves as well as helping somebody else take care of himself. So we really enjoyed it too. Merle's days were out there. We really enjoyed it as well as Francis.
Your next move was toward the interior?
Came to the Matanuska Valley when they opened up the farmland over there for the government. And came in there ahead of the farmers and ahead of the FERA workers who was in there.
That's about 34?
In 1935. Came in there on the 6th day of May. And by that night, we got in at noon on a freight train. By night, about 1,000 people showed up. Believe me, there wasn't any tents there. There wasn't anything there. But they were sure in by midnight. There's a lot of them up there, but there was that one pump there for everybody to get water out of, and that pump, I don't think, ever stopped working until it broke down. But it was, you can imagine what the sanitary possibilities were there, because there was just nothing there. And I had a tent, a little 7x9 tent. I put it up in Jim Felton's old, well, he used to have pigs out there in the pasture, and his long pigs had long disappeared, and it was green grass out there, so I put my tent out there in the corner there, and I had a radio and tied the thing up to the fence there for an aerial,
this was when the first contingent arrived at...
Yeah, this is the workers that came in.
Oh, the workers.
The
workers. This is not the farmers.
No, not the farmers. The farmers didn't show up yet.
Mm-hmm.
For this, it came on Monday. The workers came on Monday.
Where'd they come from?
California, mostly.
They brought them up to work there?
They brought them up. They got them off of the boxcars and off of the thumbed automobiles and everything else. They just brought them, period. They corralled them and sent them up there. I'm not kidding you. They just corralled anything they could corral.
And we had plenty out of work right here.
Well, they sent them out there, but anyhow, I guess they had to get rid of them.
I'd like to ask you one question. Is this at this same time, did a trainload of yellow Caterpillar tractors show up?
I'll never just tell you that because I can't remember that far back right now. But if you want to know, before anything else showed up, there was a big bunch of drills that showed up there that was twice too long for the country.
No, I asked.
I remember that.
I asked because I went out from Nome on a boat, the old wooden North Star, and then I caught her later that winter from Seattle and went down to San Francisco on her, and she loaded this boatload of tractors for and brought back to Matanuska Valley, and I saw them all on flat cars in San Francisco. And then when I came back north to Nome and came back to Fairbanks to start working, I used to have to go down and service them in Matanuska Valley.
Well, I should think that they probably would have showed up then, because they sure needed that equipment, because
clear land.
They to clear land, clear roadways, because that was a necessity. They probably showed up first, but as far as the farm equipment is concerned, they had that backwards. And as far as food was concerned, they got soap flakes and breakfast food, and that's about what they showed up with for 100 families the first night. The first time they showed up Friday, when Minnesota group showed up there, there was about 67 families in Minnesota, and they came in there with soap flakes and breakfast food. That's all they had for food.
Uh-huh.
And the rest of it wasn't on the train, wasn't on the boat. Uh-huh. So I don't know.
When you had these 1,000 workers there, what did you do with them?
Cleared land.
They cleared land and helped build the temporary housings, you know. They went right to work. They built first themselves something to sleep. And then they built the housing, the temporary housing for the farmers when they came in. They started coming in 5 days later.
Four days later.
They put them in tents. You see, they came in on tents. They were put them up in 16x21-foot tents. Don't ask me why the 21-foot, but then they had a double size. But they came in that size.
What time of the year?
They came in on the, 6th was on Monday, and 5 days later came in on Friday.
On May.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How much time did you spend in Matanuska Valley?
6.5 years, right, first. And, of course, we had, after I got there, I see that, after I put my radio going, I found out I had a good bunch of people around the fence listening, you know, and a big, and everybody wanted to find out what was going on, and particularly the new people coming up from the outside, Californians as well as the farmers from Minnesota, and when they come in on Friday, and they were stationed down another, the pasture just below us, the only cleared area around, and they were stationed down there, and they had come around over there to listen, as well as the staff folks, and then I saw what we were needing, and so I put out a paper for them.
Oh.
And brought out a news bulletin every morning, and give them the news for the day, and found out that, I must have run out about a half a dozen or more copies until I found, I see J.K. Kennedy here the other day, and Jack Ullman came in, and K. Kennedy and a couple others, but anyhow, Jack began to do something about putting out a permanent paper, and then for those are good newspaper people, well, why should I bother anymore? I think it was about 2 weeks I must have worked on this paper.
Kay Kennedy, our local...
That's right.
Girl,
and,
yeah.
That's right. And so after they got working on it, why, I decided, well, I'll just let somebody else do that work, and, you know, because they do it 10 times better than I would, I'll go to working something else. And I could see that the people were trying to congregate somewhere and no place to get to, so I talked to the head man and asked him, I said, those people need a place to get together. They need a place to congregate and have meetings, because they're meeting everywhere and the weather isn't good. And how about getting out and how about having some assembly place put up? Okay, he says, I'll give you some men and you go out there and get a place built up and then you use it for church on Sunday. Well, I gave me a great big long cross-cut saw, 6 feet long, and 2 hammers and a square, and that's about the, and an axe, and that was the equipment he gave me, and about 4 or 5 men.
To build a meeting house.
To build a building for a congregational, we built it. We cut down poles, and then we scavengered a lot of lumbers along the side, and I think some of the men swiped some off the baggage car, my box cars anyhow, in order to get some strength to the building so it wouldn't wobble to pieces. And so we got that thing put together, and we had a floor in it, and so on, and and honestly, it was not only used for church on Sunday, but it was used for the Red Cross, it was used for a library, it'd be used for the colony meetings, and homemakers. Every organization used it. And first, you know, a big sickness hit us, and they use it right now for the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the only thing they could use for a hospital.
Wonderful.
So, and then I had to go back to attend again for church. So,
that was the original Matanuska Hospital then.
That was the original hospital in Matanuska. And anyhow, then the farmers, they didn't know whether they were going to get enough food or how they were. They were on these here, chips, you know. They called them bingles at time. You know,
yes.
Those pool hall money, mm-hmm. The old Alaska saloon mm-hmm. money, you know. Mm-hmm. This called bingles, and they were operating on that kind of money, and they didn't know whether they were going to get bought food for the summer, for the winter coming up. So I suggested that there was a lot of fish in the sea out there. All they had to do was go get them if they just had the idea. So Mrs. Von Hansen was down there at the time. She was right in on it. So I went down and to Anchorage and got a couple of nets. And we borrowed a truck. And I took my car first, and then they took another. They loaned me, gave me another truck to use. The corporation did. and headed up a fishing outfit, and we went down there and collected all kinds of fish out of the sea, out of the Knick Arm, and come up with Mrs. Von Hansen, headed up the canning operation. And they canned fish, oh my, they just canned fish everywhere. Just so much of it for the valley, you know. All the farmers had chance to for the fish for the winter then.
Mm-hmm.
And they canned an unlimited amount of it. And of course, the tides were really producing fish. We get sometimes as much as 3 and probably even more than that, 300 fish in a tide, you know.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so we get
salmon,
a lot of fish.
Okay.
How's that?
Salmon.
Mm-hmm. Yes. We really were laying in fish, just as fast as you could take them in, and we'd get the fish loaded from one tide, ride the water in to Knick, and run it into town and take the fish in, and then go back and catch the water going back out, you know, to get and sleep a couple hours on the beach, and then let somebody else load your boat up, and then come back to the next water.
You knew it wouldn't last only a few days.
Well, it lasted about 4 weeks or so.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, it really
Your
was.
Cannery was in the old village at Knick?
No, it was. We used the Matanuska Experiment Station.
Oh, yes.
For the canning of the stuff. So it was really an interesting way to handle this project there. And it really worked out very fine.
Well, these are very interesting highlights. Is there any others you can think of before we leave Matanuska Valley?
Oh, I wouldn't know particularly. We had the building, of course, we built a church there. We had the men went out and cut their logs. It was headed out by Neil Miller, particularly. Neil's now down at this here Woodburn estate down south of Oregon there, south of Portland. And retirement home for senior citizens, and Neil headed up the group that went into the field out there around the Butte area, and they cut down the trees. You must have, as I say, there was 1,000 trees in that church building.
Oh.
And the men, they pulled them in to the mill, and Lawrence Arndt helped saw them up at night and prefab them. And then we brought them into the church site, and men, women, and children helped skin the logs out. And then we started to put the things together. First, we had to get rid of a big stump pile. They put all the stumps from the community center right there where they gave us a church lot. We had to get rid of that stump pile, and I'll tell you, it was higher than the church practically.
Mm.
And we had to burn that all off first. But anyhow, after we got that cleared up, well, we could build this building, and we have a nice building there. It's about 32 by 84.
This was before the first winter set in.
This was, no, we didn't get the building built till 36, 37. Before we got the building built. We used the house. I built the first house, our first house went in the fall of 35. I didn't know anything about building, but I had to build, because I had to get out of that tent. It was after below zero when we got out of the tent.
There was Mabel Bingle.
In another tent.
The two tents, huh?
Yeah. So she was in another tent.
We lived in the tent here all the summer we built this.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about.
And the mosquitoes sure can bite through those things. But they had... We had a nice summer though. It was pretty nice. There was a lot of scarlet fever there though. Our boy got scarlet fever and he's in the tent there for a while. And when the scarlet fever hit the valley there, and those youngsters were tied up in that hospital, it was really quite a serious proposition there.
What year was that?
35. Then we besides the building of the church then, we started in to work with the youth camp, you know, and we started to work on that youth camp down there at Kings Lake, and that was in 37, and we started working with Dr. Albrecht and Mrs. Albrecht and the Clyde Kings that belonged to, Clyde gave us a property, and Max Sherrod was in on that, and, And Walt Huntley was in on it in the first place, and IMC Anderson that was used to be here at the university and the farms here. And let's see, who else was on that dim beginning of the thing? Signed the property for it, the release. See, one of the farmers' wife, Mrs. Marshall, was on that. Well, anyway, they we own, as a result of that starting and getting going out with the boys that summer and camping in 36 at the beginning of Kings Lake there, and a little rock bluff there, a little out there in a little point of land in the lake in 36, and then starting this camp with Mrs. Albrecht and the Girl Scouts in 37, we now have a camp that's worth a couple $100,000 in there.
Good.
And who owns it now?
Well, it's just a group of people who are willing to pay some money and go to work, that's all. And the churches and the organizations that by virtue of their using it, they are members of the board of directors. That's all. It's just a community-owned proposition. And it's no profits to anybody. Anything you do with it, it just costs you money. Anytime you put your name down on the line, you're paying money. You aren't getting it, and you're paying money out.
Was the deed to the church, or is the deed?
No, the deed is to this Kings Lake Camp Incorporated.
Oh, Incorporated.
And it doesn't mean anything as far as it's just shooting the wad. You see, that's
yeah,
what I mean.
It's
just an organization. It's a religious, recreational, educational camp.
Your next move was where?
We came up north in 1941.
1941.
And came up here to change it into national missions work work along Alaska Railroad and highway work, and occasionally where there wasn't ordained ministers to go to the Arctic. And it was my opportunity to go to Wales, two times, twice to Wales, and once on St. Lawrence Island. And those were very enjoyable trips.
For how long?
Well, I was about 6 weeks on St. Lawrence Island, 4 weeks I think it was in a month, about a week each time over at Wales.
Did you meet Otto Geist on St. Lawrence Island?
No, he wasn't there at that time. He was there in the summertime. I was there in the wintertime.
Oh, you were there in the winter.
Yes.
Wales is quite a place, too.
Yes, Wales is. I was there when the snow was so deep that you was going in the buildings under tunnels, tunnels going under the snowbank. And I was having services in those buildings where you were going in tunnels,
I've taken the U.S. mail up there by dog team from Nome.
You were?
I have.
Oh, yes. Well, I have ridden only from Teller Mission to, Wales by dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, this brings you into the railroad area now.
Yeah.
Tell us about your railroad history.
Well, this started in 41 also, and started in going down. Well, went as far as I went to the... We had an older church at Nanana, which we hadn't quite abandoned, but we did abandon as soon as the Episcopal folks put in a priest there. But I continued to go until in the spring of 42 for some time. But I enjoyed going down to Nanana and knowing the people down there, and a number of them are still in town here yet, of course. I used to go to various places along a railroad, went to construction camps. I went to Whittier when the tunnel was through, walked through the tunnel into Whittier when the tunnel was just bored through and wasn't any rail through it yet. I used to go to West Construction before the tunnel was put through the mountain there. Used to go to the, of course, we went to the copper mine. I mean, the coal mines on the Matanuska Valley. I used to go to the Fern Mine. Of course, I made the Fern Mine before when I was in the valley, And once in a while I get up to the Lucky Shot or to the
Independent
Mine, and I did make the Lucky Shot. And I've also skied over the mountain there, over above the Gold Cord, and then over the top there, dropped over the top and down where Sid Black used to have his mine, then go down into to the old Lucky Shot. Is that the Lucky Shot? Isn't that the top one over there? The
top one, yeah.
Yeah, that's Lucky Shot. And then come down and follow the road down.
Mm-hmm. Come out at Montana?
Come down there by the old roadhouse that burned.
Oh, yes.
Fish hook.
Fish hook.
So we used to come out that way. And then we used to go up there, of course, I used to take young people up there with me, and used to go in just before full moon. And I used to have a dog with me, and he used to pull the sleds up with skis on them, and then we'd walk up and then ride the skis down and in the moonlight, you know, and come out there in the moonlight at night.
We drove up there last July. They got rope tows up there now, and the ski lodges have turned some of the old Independence Mine buildings into a ski lodge.
Yeah, that's a pretty good place, incidentally. I think that's better. It will be better, or it can be better than Alyeska.
If they'd work it up.
Yes, I think so, because that's a wonderful space up there. The snow is more to. I think it's better and it's less hazardous than Alyeska.
Alyeska is pretty dangerous.
I would think so. But I still think that Lake Tahoe is dangerous too. When you look at that hilltop, I think the same thing about Lake Tahoe. I used to cover those areas, and then could get into Willow and Talkeetna, and also make Curry. Curry was a regular stop. Get into Broad Pass and Summit, this FAA place, and then get into McKinley Park occasionally, and of course, Healy was a regular, and the coal mines up here at Santana. And then later, of course, the Usabelli was a late mine, you know, just to be developed. Mm-hmm. And then make the other section houses. Then when they developed the work train idea, I get in on the work trains, you know, on the bridge train, on the bridge gang, with the bridge crews. And I used to find out where the bridge groups were, or the bridge gang was, the bridge and building trains, and I used to go and have services in the bridge and building groups.
You remember Paul Waugh then, the conductor?
Oh yes, I knew Paul very well. Yes.
Well, I didn't know you then, but we were always passing one another. I was riding up and down on the train on service work for the NC company, and would see you from there every other day.
So, anyhow... I was sure on that road. I sure made miles on that road. I never counted how many miles I made on that railroad, but I do know that in 43 and 44 and 45, I was running between 52 and 75,000 miles with a car a year.
That was down the highway.
I was on the highway.
Now bring us through that route that you took.
Well, of course, that started in the fall of 42.
42?
In the fall of 42, and when I was happened to go out, and nobody said anything about building a highway, so I was just went down to see the Eskimo boys, was in the reindeer group that was down at Valdez, and on the way back, I saw they were doing something along. Well, I found. The army continued going into Volcana, and then I saw them coming into Big Delta. So I decided to talk to the captain, or the lieutenant there, Lieutenant Brain.
You were down at Dry Creek then, at their camp there.
I was down, if I stopped in at Dry Creek. I've been to Dry Creek a number of times, yeah.
I put all the light plants in down there.
Yeah. So I stopped in to see Lieutenant Brain, and asked him if he had a chaplain with him. He said no. And then I said, well, if I get straightened around, I'd be glad to, if you care to have me to do so, have services for you. But I'm going to be tied up now for a few weeks. And he said he'd be glad to have me. So I went back down to Valdez in about August. And on the way back, I had the services for Big Delta Post. And I took care of the services there at Big Delta for 2.5 years.
When Greeley first started up.
That's right. I had a rating under Ladd Field and under Chaplain Odom, as I recall. And I noticed that they were building a highway out to the station. I wondered what was going on. I see a bulldozer working down there. I said, back, what's going on out here? I said, they're building a highway to the station. I said, oh, somebody's going crazy here. I said, no, there aren't. Well, somebody is. I haven't heard anything about it in Fairbanks. So I said, well, they're sure building one. So I said, well, I'm going to find out who's doing this and whether I can get in on the thing. I want to find out what's going on here. And when I went to Galcana, I looked up the chaplain. I found out they had Lytle and Green brought a chaplain along. I found out he's one of our men out of Iowa. So I said, well, that's made to order.
Des Moines, Iowa.
Yeah, and so I went to see him, and he said, well, that's just fine. Now I have to leave here as in November. And so if you can make arrangements to go with me in October, I'll show you around, and you take over from me.
So
I made arrangements with him, and I went with him in October and started in Gulf Cannon. We covered the Toke Road, which is now the Glen. If you can cover that road, that thing is the windiest thing I ever seen. And I'm telling you, that was really wild. But I didn't know how many times we went around the same hill there on that thing when I first started out. But that was... then we got on we went on up and made those various camps and had services a number of them. And then we went on up to as far as we clear into the Robertson River. And at the Robertson River, he said, well, come on here, let's go down here with this fella riding a bulldozer. He said, he's going down to the river. And so we got on the front of this bulldozer, and he hadn't even been to the river yet. So we went down there, and I had my binoculars with me, and I picked out the grade stakes to find out how to get to the river, out in the weeds.
From the top of the hill on this side of the Johnson River
from the other side, on the other side. The road was on there at this side already, but the other side to the river wasn't on yet.
No, that was, they came from Toke that way.
Yeah, they came from Toke.
That way to join it.
That's right.
Well, then you were on the Salina Road when it was called the Nigger Road.
That's right. And we came into to Robertson, to the river from the other side, and as I say, I stood there watching for the grade stakes there so he could find out which way to go, because the weeds were so thick he couldn't tell where the grade stakes were.
Well, I was there at the same time.
So anyhow, that was quite interesting. And then coming back, they started working there a while, and then he said, that thing looks slippery. I'm afraid of falling in the river. So he backed up, got out of there, and says, I think I'll take it around. So that's why he made the road around it. And then when it thawed down, then he could really be blast that thing loose, I guess, and break that, get the road where it is at the present time.
They changed it, moved it up a little bit,
yes,
to get away from that.
But anyway, that was the beginning of it, and then we went on back as far as up that where Nell Kelly's old place was up there at Northway Junction, and we stayed for the night. And I stayed for the night, and the chaplain went on up clear up to the border that night to have services with the colored group, and he said the boys were sleeping on boughs up there and sleeping in tents on boughs, and he had services with the boys up there in the tent.
What time of the year was that?
That was in October, by the middle of October in 1942. And it was pretty cold, but was it muddy in there. Was that lieutenant was, when he drove through that mud, this mud sure flew. But he really had to put on the power to get through. But I know those people who were out there building, they were glad for any information they could get on Alaska. and they keep you busy answering questions that they were asking. And so I made a regular point of going back, and I went back with as much frequency as I could at the expense of the railroad. And as the men worked on shifts, and 12-hour shifts, I'd go in there and have service some places in the evening at, you know, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock. But then I'd get to another place and have a service at 11 o'clock for the men going on shift at 12. And I have services then for the ones coming off a shift at 1 o'clock in the morning. And then after their services were all, services were over, then it'd probably yak till about 3 o'clock in the morning, and then we'll get about 3 hours sleep and get up and start in the next day again. And have services probably be at 11 o'clock the next morning, next and then 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and go on for the next evening again. That's the way it was there for 4 or 5 days until you cover your field. And then of course, by that time, you're sort of getting like a hoot all yourself, you know.
And then you'd come back to Fairbanks and go down the railroad.
Yes. Or just skip something and you'll try to get some sleep, you know. Sometimes you just have to pull off in the bushes and go to sleep and wait for a sleep for a little while so you could drive. Yes.
I should think so.
But it was enjoyable. I carried later I began to picked up a projector and carried some films, because I asked one man, he asked me if I didn't have something for some films. And I had a man from New York with me, he's in film for 43, and I said, well, here's the man, he's the one that can provide the money. He said, what are you saying? And he says, well, it says if they ask for it, you get it. And so I picked up one from Don Irwin, the projector, and I used that all the time for a sound, a silent one, and until I got the sound one in 47.
How far down the highway did you reach?
I went, and when the border opened up, well, Dave Crawford helped me then for 9 months. Dave's out of Petersburg. And Reverend Crawford did a very excellent piece of work. Possibly, I figured him as about, he was a better man than I was on the job. But anyhow, Dave is good. And he's good with the men. But Dave is down at, Dave would go from Cathedral on to almost to the border. And I would take everything up as far as the Robertson. No, I think I'd go to Dot Lake with mine, and then he'd go from the Robertson on, because I was tied up with the Big Delta consistently, and I couldn't get any farther. And then we'd throw together, and quick as they got across the border, I was throw together, and we'd go from there on into the Canadian camps, clear into to 1016. And then we made two or three trips from there into Haines, into Johnson Crossing. That's 87 miles below Whitehorse. And then twice we went up on the Canal Road up there. Dave went up 225 miles and I made up 189 miles. We took every camp along the road.
Halfway to Norman Wells.
That's right. Yes. And the colonel from Mississippi, he said, I sure hope you go up there, because those men are just, we're losing too many men. He said, we just need somebody going up there down the road. So he was a fine gentleman. They were very helpful to us all the way through. But I never rode on a road that was more crooked and more steep and more smooth than that road was. It was sure steep and sure crooked and more narrow, but it was sure smooth. But that road was crooked. Ooh.
You speak from Johnson Crossing toward Norman Wells.
Toward Norman Wells. That road was crooked. But then, coming back in the Christmas time, for our first Christmases, of course, we had no bridges over the river, and these men were out in those camps, and we were trying to get those men to give them their quit or something for Christmas. And we were... we went back to town here, and we got the Legion Auxiliary and